and cuts a bunch of spending on the poor is going to be somewhat acceptable to Republicans. So I fear that the differences, especially after Donald Trump sort of bears down on everybody, will go away, and we will see some version of this pass.
David Dane, thank you so much for joining us, The American Prospect, and Dr. Adam Gaffney, Harvard Medical School former president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Up next, the Supreme Court's term has ended with more blockbuster 6-3 decisions. Stay with us.
Mon amour, ma chérie, je pense à toi, mon amour, ma bien-aimée, ne m'abandonne pas, mon amour, ma chérie. Quand je suis dans mon lit, je ne rêve qu'à toi, et quand je me réveille, je ne pense qu'à toi. Quand je suis dans mon lit, je ne rêve qu'à toi. Et quand je me réveille, je ne pense qu'à toi. Je pense à toi, mon amour, ma bien-aimée. Ne m'abandonne pas, mon amour, ma chérie. Je pense à toi, mon amour, ma bien-aimée. Ne m'abandonne pas, mon amour, ma chérie.
Of You by Amadou and Mariam, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Geneva, broadcasting from the UN Human Rights Council. The Supreme Court's term ended Friday with a decision that promises to further expand the power of the president. The case, Trump versus Casa, looks at President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship, a well-established constitutional right, with the stroke of a pen, an executive order. The court did not rule on the merits of the case. Instead, the 6-3 majority weighed in only on the authority of lower courts to restrain presidential power through the use of universal injunctions. Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote for the majority. The decision will also clear the way for other presidential policies previously blocked by universal injunction to go ahead, barring other legal means are found to prevent them from doing so. President Trump acknowledged the broad implications the ruling would have on his agenda at a press conference on Friday, where he also thanked the justices in the majority.
So thanks to this decision, we can now properly file to proceed with these numerous policies and those that have been wrongly enjoined on a nationwide basis, including birthright citizenship, ending sanctuary city funding, suspending refugee resettlement, freezing unnecessary funding, stopping federal taxpayers from paying for transgender surgeries, and numerous other priorities of the American people. This is a decision that covers a tremendous amount of territory. But I want to just thank again the Supreme Court for this ruling. It's a giant. It's a giant. And they should be very proud, and our country should be very proud of the Supreme Court today.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote for the three justices in the minority. She said, quote, no right is safe in the new legal regime the court creates. Today, the threat is to birthright citizenship. Tomorrow, a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people of certain faiths from gathering to worship. Because I will not be complicit in so grave an attack on our system of law, I dissent, Justice Sotomayor said. In a separate dissent, in some of the strongest language of the term, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson warned the ruling poses an existential threat to the rule of law. She writes, quote, This court's complicity in the creation of a culture of disdain for lower courts, their rulings and the law as they interpret it, will surely hasten the downfall of our governing institutions, enabling our collective demise, the justice wrote. And in another 6-3 decision, Mahmoud versus Taylor, the majority sided with elementary school parents in Maryland who objected to storybooks with LGBTQ plus characters at their children's elementary school. To discuss these decisions and the impact of the Supreme Court term, we're joined by two guests. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She's host of the podcast Amicus. She's joining us from Tel Aviv. And Chase Strangeau of the ACLU joins us in our New York studio. Let's go to Dahlia first. Your overall response to the last day of the term and the decisions, and specifically talk about birthright citizenship, what exactly this means.
It's good to be with you, Amy. I think that the best way to characterize this is another in a long, long series of Supreme Court aggrandizement of the Supreme Court itself. And, you know, we've seen this theme. Last year, we saw it in the case doing away with Chevron deference. We saw it in the case granting immunity to Donald Trump for the bulk of the acts involved in the January 6th insurrection. The court has, for a long time now, the Robert Six have set themselves up as the deciders. And the really frightening new twist in that plot this turn has been the court's willingness to attack district courts, to attack lower federal trial courts as they attempt to be the only remaining bulwark, right? We have a supine Congress. The only thing that has stopped more than two dozen lawless Trump initiatives has been the district courts. And this decision comes, this birthright citizenship decision, comes as the kind of low watermark of the court failing to stand up for Article III judges who are doing their jobs around the country and saying, you know what, in the end of the day, they can't do the only thing that has worked to stop Trump. And moreover, we'll decide if and when some other pathway to get to the courts is permissible too. So we have an imperial court that has created an imperial presidency, and in so doing, it has really cut off at the knees the entire judiciary below.
Dahlia, could you also explain the significance? They have focused, the Trump administration, on one phrase in the 14th Amendment, which is, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Why is that important?
Well, it's not important, and there's very, very little scholarship supporting it. And historically, we know that the drafters and the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment didn't think that it means exactly what the Trump administration and critics of birthright citizenship say it means, which is, you know, that if there is any other place that might have jurisdiction over you, then you don't have birthright citizenship. That was explicitly rejected as an idea. The idea of birthright citizenship was not if any other entity in the world has jurisdiction over you, then you are not necessarily a citizen. Not only was it rejected by the ratifiers, it was rejected in case law time after time and rejected in statutory enactments of protections of birthright citizenship. So there's no meaningful argument for it, but it's being kind of cherry-picked as the way of saying that if any other country in the world has some jurisdiction over you, then you are not necessarily a citizen of the United States. And I want to be very, very clear about this. Scholarship rejects this interpretation, case law, statutes. It is not a plausible theory. And I would add, the court didn't even address that question, the merits of that question. They simply said, we're closing the courthouse door to injunctions. Find some other way to get this urgently important question before the court.
And overall, Dahlia, why you were so incensed in everything I saw from your podcast to your writings on Friday, what you were most horrified by, birthright citizenship being one decision, but the overall framework that the court is using.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that we have to be very, very clear to see this in context, right? Because this is not, and it is certainly possible, if you read Justice Amy Coney Barrett's majority opinion, you can read it as a very lawyerly, civil pro professors, very, very abstract, theoretical application of originalism to the idea that universal injunctions are a recent invention. They didn't exist at the founding. Therefore, they cannot be a means of remediation of problems. But the problem is, and you flag this in the introduction, this comes in a context, right? This comes in a context where the court has systematically, including last week, the same week that the court took away the ability for judges to use universal injunctions, they also, on their shadow docket, on their emergency docket, they undermined a judge, Judge Murphy, in a case that had to do with deportations to third countries. They have undermined Judge James Boasberg, who's been trying to rule on renditions of people to El Salvador. So this is part of a long progression of going after lower court judges for doing what lower court judges do. And the reason, if you look at it in that larger context, and I would add in the context of, oh, come back and do this as a class action, right? Do this as a 23B class action, and maybe the court will entertain it. This is the same court that for more than 10 years has made it more and more difficult to bring a class action. So you have the court that is saying, Donald Trump, who's going after law firms that are helping people who are trying to seek relief, Donald Trump, who is signing an executive order that on its face is unconstitutional, Donald Trump, who is absolutely incentivizing people to go after lower courts, all of that is then sort of fed through this lawyer machine and made to look very sanitized. And what you are hearing in that cri de coeur from Justice Jackson in dissent, from Justice Sotomayor in dissent, is he has done something that he knows to be absolutely unlawful. It was unlawful by design. It was done as an executive order by design. And now he's made it impossible to cure it. And if you can't look at it through the lens of what is actually happening, and finally, I would say, through the lens of a Supreme Court 6-3 majority that gave Donald Trump immunity last year, then this is, as an abstraction, a useful conversation about universal injunctions. But it is not without all that context, and it is not without the context that the Biden administration asked the court to do something about universal injunctions, and the court wasn't interested. Suddenly, when Donald Trump wants to do what Donald Trump wants to do, this is an exigent matter. And to blinker yourself to all of those realities and then say this is the correct conclusion, I think is a bridge too far.
So let's bring in Chase. First, if you could respond to what Dahlia has been saying, and then the other crucial decision in Mahmoud versus Taylor, what are the implications of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I absolutely agree with Dahlia. This is a very chilling moment, and I think we should heed the two dissents and take their words very seriously. As an advocate, of course, we're ready to go into court, and in some cases, we already have certified class actions against Trump policies, and we will continue to try to get that relief every single way that we can. But we have to take seriously what is happening from this Supreme Court. And then in Mahmoud v. Taylor, we have a situation in which there is an ELA, English language arts curriculum, that includes a series of LGBT books, really books that have LGBT characters, and all opt-outs were eliminated. So that included religious opt-outs, but any other opt-outs. And I think what's chilling about this case from the 6-3 majority is the way in which they talk about LGBTQ people. They cast these books as coercive simply because they have LGBT characters. And their examples are things like two men getting married and people celebrating the marriage. That is the coercion, the fact that people are happy about a marriage, and the fact that there are trans characters in these books. So we should follow also this court that has continually cast LGBTQ people as a viewpoint and an ideology, not as a community that exists.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Chase Strangio, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union LGBTQ+ Project, and Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts and the law for Slate. Coming up in the Human Rights Council in Geneva, a Sahrawi tent of cultural resistance has been erected, made from the dresses of 19 Sahrawi human rights defenders from the occupied Western Sahara. Back in a minute.
وتسمع على الغزاة صوت النار والحديد
Layoun is on fire by Mariam Hassan, the late Sahrawi singer from Western Sahara. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I'm Amy Goodman in Geneva, Switzerland. We're broadcasting from the United Nations Human Rights Council. That is behind me right now in an unusual event. A tent has just been erected at the doorway, the entrance to the UN Rights Council, that is made of the malfi, the dresses of 19 Sahrawi human rights defenders, women who have been subjected to sexual violence, political violence by the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara. Yesterday, I had the chance to go into the tent when it was first erected and speak to the woman, the creator, the Sahrawi refugee who created it.
I'm Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! We're here in Geneva inside a Haminta. What's a Haminta? Well, we have the woman who created it here to describe. Tell us your name and what we're standing in. What is this structure?
My name is Al-Asriya Mohammed. I'm from Western Sahara, but I was born and I grew up in the Sahrawi refugee camps. And Khaymitna is actually a mini version of the tent where I grew up in the Sahrawi refugee camps. So this is very a mini version of it, and this is a storytelling, human rights storytelling project, which both convey the story of Sahrawis, their identity and their culture. So from outside, it's made from the same material. It's canvas that is typically given by the humanitarian aid, and from inside, and that's what's special about it, it has malhfa, and malhfa is Sahrawi traditional clothing. It's similar to sari. It's 3 meters.
Women's dress.
Women's dress, yes. And what's special about it, normally we would use normal plain fabric, but the new idea is that I asked 19 human rights defenders to send their clothing. Textile could be very powerful. It's the most authentic way for these women to be here. They are not allowed to be here. They are all from the occupied territories of Western Sahara.
And it's their own saris, yes. Their own dresses, yes. Their own malfas.
Their own malfas, which they wear. I mean, I don't know if we could move on the other side, but in that malfa there, it's for a human rights defender called Zainabu. And this woman, she sent me her malfa, which has actually blood stain on it. I decided to cut away the blood, but I still actually have it here. I can show it to you later. And it was from a demonstration where she was violently beaten up by the Moroccan police.
So talk about the QR codes. They look like price tags that are hanging off of each malfa.
This project was installed in Madrid and in Valencia. Yeah, when people come inside and you see it yourself, it's very colorful, it's very beautiful, and then people associate it with something positive. But then when they scan the QR codes, it takes them to women stories, to women biographies, and it, as what was very important for me, Amy, is that it's often that we only show the suffering, and these women, they spent years and years in prison. They have been tortured, they have been beaten up, they have been raped. But what is also special about Khaymetna, that I want to show the strength of them. So most of them, some of them are artists, some of them are singers, some of them are writers, and that's very important for me to also show.
And what's astounding is that this Khaymetna is going to appear at the UN Human Rights Council. It's going to be constructed right next to it.
Yes, and I think when I started this project, it was because these women are not allowed, they are often not allowed to leave their country. They are not allowed to leave the occupied territories of Western Sahara. So for me, that this Malhfas or this project, Khaymetna, will represent them. And that's, they cannot be in the UN Human Rights Council. They cannot say their stories. They cannot say their voice, but Khaymetna going to be their voice. Khaymetna is going to be their picture. And again, what is the most authentic way is that their textile, their own malhfa, that they use it in demonstration and to fight, will be fighting again for them in the Human Rights Council.
Between Morocco and Mauritania.
You've been listening to a description of the tent, the Khayma, that has been erected here at the UN Human Rights Council, made of the dresses, the malfas of 19 women human rights defenders. We're joined right now outside the UN Human Rights Council, actually overlooking it, by Maria Carrion. She's executive director of Fi Sahara, the international film festival that takes place in the refugee camps of the Sahrawis that are not in occupied Western Sahara, but are in Algeria. Maria, give us a little larger context. We just have a few minutes. Who are the Sahrawi people, and what are they calling for, and the significance of being here at the UN Human Rights Council?
I understand that many viewers and listeners may not know where Western Sahara is or that it exists. It's a territory that is located between North Africa, between Morocco and Mauritania. It was colonized by Spain. And when Spain left in 1975, Morocco invaded with the complicity and support of the United States, of France, and many other countries. There was a war after that, with Sahrawi trying to liberate it and decolonize their territory. They were bombed with napalm. Half of the population fled to Algeria, which is where, in the camps where Azria is from. And the other half stayed behind under occupation. There was a ceasefire in 1991, brokered by the United Nations, and the UN had then offered the Sahrawi people the chance to have a referendum on self-determination. It was a non-self-governed territory. Until now, that referendum has not taken place. Morocco has impeded this referendum from taking place. And
until recently, no country recognized Morocco's annexation of Western Sahara. Then, under President Trump, they became the first country, the U.S.
Exactly. And this was the Abraham Accords, of course, with Israel and Arab countries normalizing their diplomatic relations. Everyone named their price. Morocco named their price, and their price was U.S. recognition of sovereignty.
I want to go to the person who introduced the side panel, who hosted it, the ambassador to the UN Human Rights Council here in Geneva. He's from South Africa, the South African ambassador, Nkosi.
The heart-wrenching testimonies that we've listened to from Sahrawi women who are on the front lines, who are at the receiving end of the repression by the security forces of Morocco. Indeed, their voices will never be silenced. The courage of Sahrawi women comes squarely to the fore. In the illuminating report, Resilience in Resistance, highlighted by panelists. The report documents how Sahrawi women endure widespread systemic human rights violations for simply daring to resist injustice. These violations form part of a deliberate misogynistic strategy, what the report terms wheel of reprisals against Sahrawi women because of their gender and status in society, in order to instill a climate of fear. This is because through their resistance, Sahrawi women effectively expose the carefully crafted narrative which seeks to whitewash the brutality of foreign occupation. This side event, therefore, is especially timely given that the June session of the Human Rights Council is commonly referred to as the gender session. As such, it is a pity that many states who profess to be advocates of human rights and gender champions are not here with us today. Their absence is conspicuous. It speaks volumes, and it leaves an impression, namely that Sahrawi women, and indeed all women under foreign occupation, are somehow less than human. As a country that prizes gender equality, for South Africa, the violence and discrimination being perpetrated against Sahrawi women can never be countenanced. Indeed, we are a nation born of women human rights defenders who fought valiantly against apartheid to secure equity for women, not only in our country, but everywhere else in the world. South Africa, therefore, is pleased to be associated with this event. This is more so the case as the struggle of the Sahrawi women does not exist in a vacuum, but forms part of a broader struggle for the self-determination of Western Sahara.
That's the South African ambassador and permanent representative of South Africa to the UN Human Rights Council here in Geneva, Ambassador Nkosi. Maria Carrion, you're executive director of NOMADS HRC and the head of the Fi Sahara International Film Festival that takes place in Algeria. It's filled with more than 100,000 Sahrawis who have taken refuge from Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara. We just have a minute, but if you can respond to the significance of the South African ambassador hosting this. I also testified, because Democracy Now! Is the last journalist to get into Western Sahara, and we did a documentary called 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. What people are calling for here?
They're calling for respect for human rights of the people of Western Sahara. They're calling for the UN to have a monitoring system, human rights monitoring system, which they do not in Western Sahara. They're calling for a chance to have a referendum on self-determination for Sahrawis to decide their future. They've been waiting for over 30 years for this. And
the significance of this side panel hearing?
It's important to have also South Africa supporting the Sahrawi people. South Africa is a longtime supporter of liberation movements around the world, and it has always been on the side of the Sahrawi people.
We'll be doing more on this, and people can check out the documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, at democracynow.org. Maria Carrion, thank you so much. Back to you, Nermeen, in New York.
And that does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now! Special thanks to Poon Echevarri, Romain, and François in Geneva. And a very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. We're hiring for multiple positions. Please see democracynow.org jobs.
You're listening to CJSF. 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.